welcome to episode 88 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm joined by my long-suffering co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David. How are you today?
Not too bad. Not suffering too badly today. That's fine. Thank you.
Oh, I just put the long-suffering in because you've got to put up with me and everything that all the mess that I make of things. So
No. It's all fine.
That was the pointer, but how have you been getting on?
Oh, pretty well. Yeah, we've been doing the usual sort of things. Nothing varies very much in our life, really. But we're just ticking away.
All right. Okay. Well, that's good. I think since our last episode, I've become an empty nester. My son's moved out.
Wow.
Had to help him shift, so that's all done. And he's now gone off to his own apartment, and so we're bouncing around inside this house now, my wife and I, and it's all a bit weird, trying to get used to it, trying to work out, just strange things that change in your domestic arrangements, like how often you wash and wash your clothes,
and how big a meal you cook.
Do we want leftovers for 2 weeks rather than just the one that we normally have?
We went through that when our daughter got married. So yeah,
it's a bit of an adjustment. You don't realize it, but then you think, oh well, we're only down a third, and then you think, well, you're down a third in some things. But he was a young man in his 20s, and he liked his food, so you're down quite a fair bit on food that you have to buy. And suddenly you're looking at it, and I keep saying to my wife as we're going around the supermarket, now don't forget, we're only shopping for two now, not for three. And that's something that's got to be taken into account. So yeah. Anyway,
that's right. Well, it's all part of life's rich tapestry, isn't it?
Really? Rich tapestry. There you go. Yes. Well, the other part. Speaking of which, the other part of life's rich tapestry is the bit where it unravels, and we've had a bit of that lately with the passing of three fairnish friends of the podcast, Charles Taylor, who's a Melbourne science fiction fan, a popular attendee of the Nova Mob, Valma Brown, who was the long-term partner of one of our guests, Lee Edmonds, who's been on here a number of times, and a very old friend of mine, Eve Harvey, she was a UK fan, wife of John Harvey, living in France, rather, had been living there for a number of years, and she passed away. So that was very unfortunate. Three dying in the space of just over a week.
Yes,
it's comes as a bit of a shock. One's bad enough, but when you get three of them in a quick succession, you start getting a sense of your own mortality, David.
Yes, you do.
I don't particularly like it very much.
No.
I don't think any of us do. I think that I would rather basically not be reminded so very often. So that was a bit sad. But we give our thoughts are with everybody, friends and family of all of those three.
Absolutely.
It's always a hard time.
And, very hard.
You and I have been through it, and with people in our family, our parents, it's going to happen again, so unfortunately. But let's move on to other and crazier and
more topical
weirder things. See if you can give me an update on what's happening with ChatGPT now. I mean, it is not going away, David. It's not going away.
What worries me is the eagerness with which all these corporations are leaping upon it and assuming that it will be the be-all and end-all and solve all their problems, and they'll be able to get rid of people in their organizations and replace them with this kind of system. But I find that part of it very disturbing, because these systems are deeply flawed. If you actually do interrogate them for any length of time, you know, they're very good at producing a very confident answer. As we said last time, it's like automated mansplaining, you know, very, very confident, bombastic. This is the answer to this. But then you look at the results, and they're very, very often wrong. And what worries me is, I think I may have said this last time, so I hope I'm not repeating myself too much, but, you know, if you build these things into search engines, how do you fact check what they come back with? Because if your only means of fact checking is to use the same search engine, you're not going to be able to see whether the answer it's given you is right or wrong. So that's really, it's worrying. I think the idea of giving these things responsibility for anything that actually impacts people's lives, like, oh, you know, we can replace judges and lawyers with these things, it's insane.
Yes.
There's actually a very good book, I mentioned this to one of our friends, very, very good book written in the 1970s by Joseph Weizenbaum, who was the guy who invented the ELISA system, which pretended to be a psychiatrist asking you questions. And he has a book. He had a book out called "Computer Power and Human Reason," and it's still absolutely spot on, accurate as to how we should deal with these things. You shouldn't give them responsibility for dealing with things that really require a human to be involved in, a human judgment to be involved in. You know, because by definition, these things don't know what it's like to be human.
No.
You know, they don't know what it's like to have relationships with other people. They don't know what it's like to live with the knowledge that one day you're going to die. You know, they're not human, and we shouldn't treat them that way. I think that's the real danger in them. Anyway, so that was my little rant for today.
I think they've just put it out too early. I mean, I think that you can understand the enthusiasm inside the organisations. Wow, this thing's sort of absolutely fantastic, and it's producing all these results, and isn't it wonderful? People either didn't test it enough or didn't basically run it through the real world enough. And it feels to me like this is part of the solution, but it's not the whole solution that is being touted, by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah.
It has a fundamental flaw, and that's that it bases itself on all the text and stuff that it's read, but it has no understanding of what it actually has read.
I mean, somebody said, well, I can pass a bar exam. Well, of course it can.
You have to be fed with thousands of bar exam questions and thousands of bar exam answers. Of course it can. You know, it's like saying, oh, my goodness, computers can play chess. Of course they can. It's a limited domain. They know what, it's a fixed set of rules. Of course they can.
That's the whole point. If the application is placed over a limited domain, well, then, yes, you can understand that it may have a fairly good chance of being mostly accurate, but it still doesn't understand what it's doing.
No,
it still doesn't understand what it's saying. It's parroting what it's read and what it's picked up and trying to get it to make connections. All it's doing is it's regurgitating other people's connections between different and disparate texts to come up with some sort of answer.
Mm.
And, on the face of it, it might seem as though it looks all right, but you got to dig into these things and start asking it more and more questions. And then you find out it really isn't all that flash after
That's
all.
Right.
But anyway, the reason why I keep bringing this up, David, is because it just keeps on popping up in the media. Mm. You see it all over the place and you see it being spoken about. And so you sort of think, is this an indication that society in general has hit a point where it's starting to think that we could make some fundamental jumps in AI development? Maybe. I don't see them as yet. I think we're still a fair ways off. I mean, it's the classic thing, isn't it? Like new drugs that come out. They're always 10 years away, David. Yeah. Always 10 years away. And AI is a bit like, controlled fusion reactors. They're always about 10 years away. 30 years away for some of them. Well, yeah. I think AI fusion is... I think controlled fusion reactors are getting a bit closer, but they're...
30 years.
You still think it's 30
years? I do. I think it'll always be 30 years.
Oh, okay. No, I think that might be a little bit... I think we might be getting there a little bit quicker than that. But it's just interesting, and it's a good thing to keep an eye on because, of course, science fiction has covered and looked at the question of AIs for so many years. Right back to the time of the AUR robots from Carl Chapek.
Chapek, I think it is.
Chapek, yeah. His robots. So And then on from there, and, you know, was Frankenstein an artificial intelligence? Constructed, it was a constructed being.
It was a constructed body, but it had a,
yeah, okay, all right. Maybe I'm stretching things a little bit, but I tried. My wife's had a, as of you and I have discussed, has had a hip replacement operation recently, and I said, well, we're starting to become part cyborg now, so, you know, you'll, we'll have fun when we go through the airport and we'll set the alarms off. But I think the ChatGPT is, it's an interesting subject to discuss.
Oh, it's fascinating.
It is, but I think we'll just go round and round and round in circles for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I think the wheels are spinning, but it hasn't actually got through the gravel yet. And it hasn't hit the road. The rubber hasn't hit the road properly yet. But when it does, it may well take off in a really big hurry. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. All right.
Indeed. All right.
Anything further on that?
I don't think so. I think we've done that to death.
All right. Time for a bit of news.
News. Yeah, you've got all the news.
Oh, I've got all the news. Well, As you may be aware, David, there are massive numbers of awards inside the science fiction and fantasy genres, and quite a number in the crime and mystery genres as well. But it seems to be that the science fiction and fantasy genres get in first, and there's a few of them that have popped up just over the past couple of weeks. One of the big ones is the Nebula Awards. This is the awards given out by the science fiction and fantasy writers of, well, they used to be Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. I think they've changed their name to the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association now. You don't have to be based in America to become a member anymore.
No, that's interesting.
I think that's right, but maybe I should look that up before I started ranting. But anyway, so this is the second big award after the Hugos. And this is given out by, if we look at the Hugos as being given out by the fans and the readers, the Nebula Award is given out by the professional writers. And so the ballots have now been released. And awards for the Nebulas are given in the categories of best novel, novella, novelette, short story. So that's the four major fiction award categories. And then they also have an Andre Norton Award for young adult fiction and the Ray Bradbury Award for screenplays. And also a game writing award. Now, I'm not going to go into all of them because there'll be so bloody many, we'll be here forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just give you the novel nominees, David, because I think it's a bit interesting, the novel nominees. And they are Legends and Lattes by Travis Baldry, Spear by Nicola Griffith, which I'm hearing very good things about, Nettle and Bone by Ting Kingfisher, Babel by R.F. Quang, which you reviewed last time.
Last time, I think, yeah.
Last time, yep. You quite enjoyed, I believe.
Very much.
Nonna the Ninth by Tamsin Muir, which is the third in her space opera necromancer series. And The Mountain in the Sea by Ray Naylor, and that's the one that Chong really enjoyed.
Yes, I must get to that.
Yes, I must get to that as well. But it's interesting to note that there's no mention of Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel, which you and I both...
Certainly expected it to be on the Hugo list, but maybe not.
I expected it to be on the Nebula list. The Hugo list, I've got absolutely no way of reading the Hugo list this year, given that the vast bulk of members of the Worldcon are going to be from mainland China. Who knows what they
nominate.
Yeah. It could be anything. They may not nominate at all. But if they do, who knows what it's going to be.
It could be very interesting.
It could be very interesting. But it could be... yes, I don't know whether... I don't know whether the... I'm not that much of an aficionado of the Hugo Awards rules to know whether it's absolutely essential that the entries on the ballot must be available in English. I don't know. I think so, which might be interesting. Anyway, the other one we have, that's a major American award for the Nebulas. The next one is the BSFA, which is the British Science Fiction Association shortlist. So they're awards for the 2022 works are now up and available. The awards are presented in the category of Best Novel, Best Short Fiction, that's basically anything under 40,000 words, so that's novella, novelette, and short story, non-fiction, and a book for younger readers, and artwork. Now, these have been presented since 1969, and the Nebulas have been awarded since 1966. So the BSFA awards are probably the third, though I think possibly the Australian Science Fiction Achievement Awards, otherwise known as the DITMARs, probably kicked in just a year or so before. So we may
never,
be third.
You never hear much about the DITMARs these days, do we?
No, we never do anyway,
but that doesn't mean anything.
No, the other major Australian Science Fiction Awards are the Aurealis Awards, and the shortlist for those have been announced. And there's a large number of categories in this one. This is all about recognising the best in Australian speculative fiction. And they give awards for best novel, best novella, and best short story in each of the genres of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and young adult. So that makes 12 categories. They do best children's fiction, best collection, best anthology, and best graphic novel or illustrated work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a fair slab of awards to be given out there and covering just about everything. And again, I'm not going through the list because there's just so many on these lists that, as I said, you'll be here forever. And it's better that, I've read practically none of them. Probably have read none of them. So I wait for the award list to come out and then sort of check to see which ones I should be looking at.
Hmm. I'm looking at it now. I think this is the current year. Only a Monster is the only one of those I read. That's the young adult section.
Yeah.
No, I haven't read any of the novels now.
No, I haven't either. So basically, we'll have a look at that when it comes up and when they get when the winners get announced. I'm not sure when that's going to be, but we'll keep an eye on it and let people know when that's going to be happening.
Yeah, June, I think.
Right, yeah, okay, so mid-year probably. I think the BSFA awards are generally handed out at their EasterCon, and I think the Nebulas are sometime May-June, I think.
Mm.
Not terribly sure exactly when. The Hugos, of course, as I said last week, the nomination ballots are now out and available, so that if you are a member of this year's Worldcon or were a member of the Chicago Worldcon, you can nominate, but you can only vote for the awards if you're a member of the Chinese convention. And so you'll have to basically join up with that. How you do that, I have absolutely no idea. I voted in the site selection process in Chicago, and therefore I'm a... they've given me an attending membership, but I'm not going to be attending. But it will be the same as the supporting in the sense that I'll be able to get all of the... I'll be able to vote. I'll be able to vote for the site selection. And I will also get a copy of the Hugo packet, which comes out each year, which gives a large slab of the Hugo nominees when they are released. So you can read through all of that.
Okay.
But it's about all of my news, David. I'm just about done with that. Do you have anything else?
No. I've been very remiss in sort of keeping an eye open for things. But, I mean, there's a few books that have been announced and so on, but we don't normally cover those sort of things. They could go on forever. About new books coming out.
Oh, yeah. So we start talking about what books we're looking forward to, and then we should put a caveat on the end. These are the books I'm looking forward to, but probably don't. We'll never get a chance to read.
That's right.
So we'll just move on from those.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll move on to our major topic for this particular conversation, David.
Indeed.
We're moving back to crime fiction this time, away from the science fiction and fantasy genres, although we have at times had a science fictional crime novel. But they, you don't get too many of those, but they're interesting when they turn up. But in this instance, no. There's a little bit of something in one of the books that I'm going to be talking about today, but I'll get to that a bit later on. It's a book that I know that you've read. But do you want to start us off, David? You've been read lately?
So in the crime genre, what I've been reading recently. The first one I've got is called Unforgiven by Sarah Barry. Now, she's been around for a while, Sarah Barry, but I hadn't come across her before. The only reason I did was that I buy a lot of e-books from Kobo Books, and I get this sort of very frequent newsletter every so often saying, look, you may be interested in this. And they were offering a very cheap deal on this book, Unforgiven, and its sequel, Retribution. So, down to a couple of bucks each. So I thought I'd give it a go. And I'm pleased that I did. Unforgiven is structured in a way I see quite often these days. Two points of view, one of them told in the first person and one told in the third person. Now, here the first person narrative is that of Lexi Winter, who it turns out is a sex worker, but she's a very smart, tough character, hardened by her life experiences, which we slowly discover. She drinks far too much. She's also very clever with computers. There are obvious similarities with Lisbeth Salander, the main character in Stieg Larsson's trilogy, which begins with the girl with the dragon tattoo. But this book isn't a direct steal of Larsson's work. It does share the theme of the sexual abuse of children and the mistreatment of women. Anyway, as well as her sex work, Lexi uses her knowledge of computers and familiarity with the dark web to help track down abusers, and often by pretending to be an 11 or 12-year-old girl, attracting potential groomers on social media. And she's doing this to help her younger sister, Bailey, who works for the social services department as a caseworker. Bailey wants to get knowledge of abusers who may be targeting young victims who have been referred to her because they're in vulnerable situations. The other storyline in the third person centres on Detective Inspector Rachel Langley, who is now in her late 40s. 20 years previously, she tracked down a paedophile and murderer calling himself the Spider and had him imprisoned for life. His name was Thomas Biddle, and he's still in jail, though now reportedly suffering from terminal cancer. But there's a 20-year retrospective television special about the case, and after that, Detective Langley is contacted by an anonymous caller who insists that he is in fact the Spider and that she got it wrong 20 years ago. He appears to know many details of the case, which give credence to the claim, and then he tells her that he's going to commit another abduction and murder of a child, which indeed he does. Anyway, the investigations of these two people, Lexi Winter and Rachel Langley, eventually come together in a very satisfying way, and they join forces to track down the man claiming to be the Spider. Look, I enjoyed this a lot. It's a fast-paced thriller, kept the pages turning. Both of the main characters are interesting and they're far from stereotypical. Lexi in particular has considerable depth, and I liked her cynicism and scepticism of police procedures. I do get rather irritated though with how simple the author makes it appear for a hacker to break the passwords on people's computers using some sort of software magic or sheer genius. In reality, it doesn't work that way at all. The majority of password breaches are done through social engineering or phishing exercises where people are tricked into giving away their passwords. Setting that aside, however, I will be rolling on to read the sequels, Retribution, to see how that pans out. So, yeah, I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I was actually watching something last night where somebody had to try and crack a password on a video camera, and he said, it could take a couple of days. It's a software app that I've written. Oh my god.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. You're right, okay. Yep. Same sort of stuff you see everywhere, David. As you say, it's all over the place.
Yeah, but it's a pity, but yeah.
Well, it goes along with the idea that every time something comes up on the screen, it makes a clacking noise like a typewriter, doesn't it? Remember that?
Yeah.
Oh god. Spare me. Anyway, these are just sound effects and just stupid things that they put into movies because people think that's what actually happens, but it's not. There we go. Right, well, I'm going to be... my first novel here is going to be an original French crime novel by an author called Fred Vargas, Now, it might sound like, with a name like Fred Vargas, that we're talking about a male author, but in fact, we are not. Because Fred Vargas is the pseudonym of, and I'm possibly going to get this wrong, David, so forgive me, Frederic Audin Rousseau, who was born in 1957. She's a French historian, archaeologist, and novelist. Mm. Now, she has written a series of books featuring Chief Inspector Adamsberg, one of which I previously reviewed on this podcast. Now, what was the name of that one? Oh, A Chalk Circle Man, that's right. So that was the first of them that was published published by Fred Vargas. This is the second, and so far I believe there have been five, and I think all five now have been published in English. So this was a book from 1999 called Seeking Whom He May Devour, which is a strange little title, and this is a strange little book as well. It's translated from the French by David Bellos, and was nominated for a Crime Writers Association, that's the British Crime Writers Association, Silver Dagger Award in 2005. So originally published in 99, Silver Dagger Award nomination 2005. So I think that was probably for the English translation, which makes sense. Now, the first quibble I've got with this particular book in terms of the publication that I had in front of me was that I had to search the fine print on the copyright page to discover the name of the translator of this novel. It's not even included on the page containing the translator's note in terms of, and so they didn't even put the person's translator's name at the bottom of that, nor have they got Fred Vargas translated by such and such. And I think that when you're doing translations of work, you're reading two people's work, really. Mm. You're reading the original author, and then you're reading the person who actually translated it. And you need to know who those two people are. And I think it's vitally important that the names go on the front. I'm fully aware of the fact that the original work done by the original author should be in type that was larger than the translation to translators. No problem with that. But I think the translator's name should be on the front cover.
Sure.
Somewhere. So not only do you know that it's translated, but you know who it's translated by. Right. Rant of the day over, David. Well, I may come up with a couple more later on, but that's my first one.
We're doing a bit of ranting today.
Anyway, so this novel, it's a bit of a strange crime novel, this one, because for a lot of it, you don't even know it's a crime novel. So the novel starts off concentrating on the death and mutilation of a number of sheep in the Provence area of France. It appears that there's a giant wolf roaming the area, preying on sheep. Now, this is a descendant from an Italian wolf pack that crossed the Alps into southern France. But it's only attacking ewes. It's not attacking lambs or anything else. And so this is a bit odd right off the mark because, you know, a wolf, if it's hungry, will basically go for the easiest thing it can get, and it will separate the lamb from the ewe and then attack the lamb. Why would you go after the mother? I know it's bigger, but why would you do that? Doesn't make a lot of sense. Anyway, so this carries on for a while. Nobody can really figure out what's going on. It's popping up all over the place, and the number of sheep that are being killed and mutilated is starting to get a bit of national coverage. And details of it have been shown around France. And then a local woman is killed, and it looks like the same wolf was responsible. Now, again, this is a bit peculiar because wolves won't attack humans, although as much as you might think from the movies that all that somebody has to do is basically bleed a bit and the wolves will come around and try and attack them. No. The wolves don't go for anything bigger than they are because they're smart and they know that it's going to take a lot of effort to bring something down. And if they don't get it done exactly right, they could be in a bit of trouble. So they will always go for something smaller. So why then is this woman been killed by this particular wolf? And they know it's been killed by the wolf because the jaw marks are exactly the same. And this is a massive wolf, a really huge thing according to the jaw. And so everybody's very, very intrigued by it. And then a strange local man who's been away for a number of years and returned back to the village where all these wolf attacks have been taking place goes missing. The police thinks that, you know, he's died out on the mountaintop sometime when he was on a hunting expedition because his money and papers were left behind. But three particular locals are very convinced that he's the one that's been responsible for all the killings, including the killing of the woman, and set out to track him down. They believe that he's somehow tamed a particular wolf, and this wolf is doing the bidding of this gentleman that's gone missing. And watching from afar up in Paris, intrigued, is Inspector Adamsberg, the recurring character all the way through this particular series of novels by Fred Vargas. Now, he finds himself seconded off to an area of France where these three people are searching for this missing man. And as it happens, one of the three happens to know Adamsberg and tries to contact him in Paris, only to find out that he's in the general area of the central part of France, and tracks him down and gets him involved in trying to determine what's going on and where this man is. It's a rather intriguing mystery that carries on throughout this particular book, but it takes a long time to get into its stride. For example, Inspector Adamsberg doesn't really show up properly. I mean, he's got one small little chapter at the beginning where he's watching what's going on in the south of France while he's working on another case. So he's intrigued by all these wolf killings and wonder what's happening. And then you don't see him again until you get to about page 180 out of a 288-page novel. So we're most of the way through it before he even shows up. So that's a bit odd. But anyway, it all ends well, and it's all tied up properly, and it all sort of comes together without any cheating by the author. And it makes sense. I didn't pick what the resolution was. I didn't pick who the perpetrator was, though I probably suspect my wife would have done far better than I do. She normally does with these things. But I don't know. Was it that I wasn't paying attention? Maybe it was because the author was able to hide things quite well. And there's a bit of that in today's discussion about the author hiding some of the clues, not leaving them out, because you think back over it and you go, that makes sense. This happened and that happened. I mean, it's when you get the author sort of cheats and, you know, you sort of think, it's far too contrived for there to be a ready resolution of the mystery. I didn't get the feeling that was the case in this particular instance. And so, you know, it was interesting. It's just a bit weird because it reads like a rural country novel where people are basically losing sheep to a wolf for most of the book before a crime actually seems to take place. So it's okay. I'll read more in this particular series because I'm trying to spread my reading of crime novels a bit past the straight Anglo-Saxon, you know, US, UK and Australia nexus. I want to sort of move out a little bit into a few other things. So this one's acceptable, not super fantastic. So I gave it 3.3 out of 5.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to move on to one which I probably would give about the same sort of value to, which we'll get to at the end. So this one's called In Her Blood by Nikki Crutchley. Now, Nikki Crutchley is a New Zealand writer, and her books have twice been shortlisted for the Nio Marsh Award, which is New Zealand's premier award for crime fiction. But unfortunately, I found this one, In Her Blood, to be both disappointing and annoying, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. Okay, so we have a story which is told in three parallel streams, two of them set in the modern day and the third in a series of flashbacks to events 22 years earlier. So as the book opens, we're introduced to a teenage girl called Charlie, who wakes up to find herself in a dark room. She has no idea where she is and soon finds that she's confined within some kind of cage. Then we switch to a young woman called Jack Morgan, J-A-G-G see Jack Morgan, who's returning to her hometown after a 7-year absence. She had left there under a cloud, accused of causing a fire in her home, which killed her mother, though her father and younger sister Charlie escaped. She's returning now because she's been sent some disturbing texts by her father, telling her that Charlie's gone missing. But when Jack arrives, she finds that her father's dead, apparently having fallen into a lake while drunk, which was his habitual state. No one knows where Charlie is, and the police aren't very interested. Eventually, Jack, who is broke, finds her way up to an old hotel on the hill above the town. There she encounters Iris Gilmore, who is a strange old lady who owns the place. Iris offers Jack a job and accommodation. And this is apparently deeply resented by the old lady's daughter, Lisa, who looks after her aging and sometimes bewildered mother. Through the book, we get flashbacks from Lisa's point of view about her childhood, during which she was treated with irrational cruelty by her mother, who greatly favoured her eldest daughter, Paige. But 22 years ago, Paige went missing, never to be heard of again, though her mother insists, even after all this time, that she'll return someday. And it's clear that she's drifting into senile dementia. So Lisa's story is interleaved with short chapters from Charlie's point of view, still locked up somewhere, brought food and water while she's asleep, but she never sees her captor. And also chapters from Jack's point of view. She tries to find out where Charlie's gone, without much success. It was pretty obvious to me anyway, that from early on, that Lisa and Iris and the old hotel must have something to do with Charlie's disappearance in the modern narrative, and that she's probably imprisoned in or near the hotel somewhere. You're just really just waiting for the details to be revealed. So I just found the story dragged on quite a bit, waiting to get to that point and having some explanation of why this has all happened. And I really had to push on to keep myself reading. And when we get to the solution of the mystery of what happened to both Charlie and to Paige, it really relies on two of the characters being pretty much insane or out of their heads, and not, for me, in a very believable way. And nothing of this comes about through Jack's actions. She's just basically a bystander and observer. I can't recommend this one. I didn't like it much at all.
It sounds like it was written from the point of view that the author started off with an idea of how they get the thing started, and as they got further and further into it, couldn't quite work out how to close it off.
I guess so. Yeah, there is a solution, and it's a sort of interesting story. But it's pretty predictable. I mean, I could see right from the start who done it, if you like. But really, the revelation, I suppose, is kind of why. But even that's pretty well flagged, I think, pretty early. So yeah, I wasn't impressed by this one. So I don't think I'll go hunting up any more of this author's writing, unless something gets really well recommended.
All right. Okay. My next one from 1935. I'm going back and trying to fill in some of my the holes in my reading from way back, and working my way through some of some crime writers' series. And this book is titled "The League of Frightened Men" by Rex Stout. Now, this is this is the second in the author's Nero Wolfe series of novels, of which there are something like 70. So,
good heavens!
The way I'm going, I'll never get there. This one is generally considered to be one of his better ones, and appears on the Guardian 1000 novels list. So that's a list of 1,000 novels that probably you should read. Sort of the equivalent of the 1,001 novels you should read before you die, but they came up with a set of 1,000 novels that they split into different categories. Crime was one, science fiction, love, war, family, comedy, that sort of stuff. So this is one of the crime novels, and so it's one of about 140, 150 crime novels on the list. It's considered to be pretty good. Now, it's a rather complicated affair, as you would suspect, and there's lots of red herrings, naturally, and a long list of subjects, and a fairly large array of characters that are going around through this particular novel. It's most like most crime novels of this particular time, which have a lot of longevity, it concerns two major characters that are the major detective, that is Nero Wolfe, and his offsider, Archie Goodwin. This is the equivalent of, you know, Holmes and Watson, Dylan Pascoe, Mawson Lewis, all these ones. There's always generally two people that are working together that are sort of bouncing things off each other. Wolfe, in this instance, is a private investigator who is a very intelligent man, but he's also very corpulent and does not like to leave his New York brownstone. He's got this very large 3 or 4 levelled house in New York, with elevators going up and down, and he allocates his time meticulously to a certain patch during the day to his work, that is his private investigation work, and also in the afternoon. He has his meals out at exactly the same time, and he has a whole big slab of time in the middle of the day, which he spends with his personal gardener, looking at his orchids up in the up in the glasshouse on top of the building. He's a really weird sort of character, but he's very well known, and these are really well known series of books. This one in particular revolves around a hazing incident at a college outside New York, which happened some 25 years before the novel starts. And in that incident, a young man by the name of Paul Chapin fell from a building and was badly injured. Now, all of the young men who sort of basically forced him to do something which caused him to fall have pitched in over the time and tried to help him out and been apologetic, but they're all having to live with the fact that they caused this man some major injuries. He's now sort of fallen on his feet, so to speak. A pun that slipped out that I didn't really mean it to, but anyway, he's actually now become rather successful. But several members of the group of men that set him up 25 years before, who refer to themselves, which is the League of the Title, have died. And Chapin is now the main suspect because he happens to have been around a couple of these incidents where these deaths have occurred. Although the police can't actually nail him specifically for the deaths. So it's all a little bit open. A couple of the League have engaged another private investigation group. And Nero Wolfe somehow decides to... realises that he's been a bit bored, comes across this case in the papers, and it decides to sort of insinuate himself into the case, into the extent that the other PI team just basically give up because Wolfe has decided he's interested and he wants to do some work in it. And he starts working around trying to figure out what's going on. And it's a rather roundabout fashion in which he actually gets to the final solution. And it's a bit complicated and slow in the early parts before it actually picks up. But later on, Chapin really gets arrested after another of the League is murdered. And he happens to be actually in the building, in the foyer of the building, in the same room where the guy was killed. And he's arrested by the police because it also seems to point to him as being the culprit. So Wolfe basically takes over. He starts working for Chapin as well to try to work out what's going on. And they finally get through to a solution. It's... look, it's okay. I gave it 4 out of 5, so I thought it was pretty good in the end. But as I said, it's a rather slow going to get started. I would suggest that people start back at the first one and then work their way through. But from what I've been reading about this, you're starting to get the quirks of all the major characters, like the major police inspector who turns up. You're getting a bit more about Wolfe and Archie Goodwin and how they work together, and also the other people that work in the house for Nero Wolfe. And so this is sort of one of those ones, it's series that sort of gradually builds over the journey. So you get more and more information about the characters as you go. The crimes are interesting, worth reading. But as I said, this one is a tad slow to start off with.
Hmm. Okay. Now, well, it's interesting. So the Nero Wolfe character is a bit sounds a bit like Mycroft Holmes, you know, wanted to sit in his office and use his brain power to solve things.
It's probably a good an analogy as you're going to get. So he just basically doesn't like leaving, like Mycroft never liked leaving his offices. He would basically just get all the information brought to him, and then he would make his theories based on that, and then work his way through.
He was also very corpulent sort of character too, I think, too.
Yeah, he was. So the same sort of thing.
Similarities there.
Probably is some similarities, yeah. Mm.
Yep. Yeah, interesting. I'm going to roll on to a book called Shrines of Gaiety by Kate Atkinson. Now, I was in a little bit of doubt, as Perry knows, as to whether to call this a crime novel, but Kate Atkinson has in fact written quite a few books which certainly fall more strongly into the crime category. She's written a series of books with a private investigator called Jackson Brodie, which are all excellent, starting with a book called Case Studies. But none of those, even so, none of those is really sort of traditional crime. They're all got a bit of a slightly different spin. So anyway, she's a writer I really like, so I certainly was keen to get hold of this, which has only just come out last year, I think. Okay, so this is Shrines of Gaiety. So the book is set in 1926 in an England which is trying to forget and move on from the loss of life in the Great War, which was 1914 to 1918. The central theme is the nightclub scene in London at the time and the more than slightly crooked people who ran these clubs. So the novel opens with an eager crowd outside the gates of Holloway Prison, awaiting the release of Ma Coker. Ma, or Nellie Coker, we learn subsequently, is the matriarch of a family running a series of nightclubs across London. And she's been in jail for breaching the licensing laws controlling the sale of alcohol, but it's also suspected that her clubs are a front for prostitution. Now, the book gives us the viewpoints of a host of characters around this central core. There's Nellie Coker herself and each of her many children, from the eldest Niven, who's just returned from fighting in the trenches, down to young Kitty, who's in her early teens and probably the cleverest of them all. We're introduced to a police officer who's investigating Coker's activities, Detective Chief Inspector John Frobisher. He's investigating Nellie Coker's clubs in particular because he suspects a connection with the deaths or disappearances of a series of young women, some of whose bodies have been found floating in the Thames. Frobisher's also trying to sort out corrupt police in the Bow Street station to which he's recently been assigned. Now, he's a very dedicated man in this official position, but he suffers greatly at home from the mental illness of his French wife. And then there's perhaps the most interesting character in the whole book, Gwendolyn Kelling, who's in her early 30s, who's just moved to London, leaving behind her job as a librarian in York, to look for two young girls, Frieda and Florence, who have run away from their homes in York, apparently to seek their fortunes on the stage in London. But they've never been heard of since after leaving home. In this quest to find these girls, she meets up with Inspector Frobisher, who suspects that they may have fallen victim to the same villain or villains as the others that he's looking into. Now, Gwendolyn isn't the mousy librarian she might seem on the surface, but an intelligent and independent woman determined to seek her own way in life. She eagerly accepts Frobisher's suggestion that she go undercover into Nellie's clubs and report back to him about what's going on. But she gets in much deeper than she expects. Nellie Coker, meanwhile, has her own concerns as she battles to fight off two separate attempts by men to take over her clubs, who are using a variety of corrupt methods to do so. But although she's now getting old, Nellie is certainly no pushover for these blokes, and she pushes back pretty strongly. So all of these characters are well developed and full of interest, and the many different threads of story interact in what I felt was a very satisfying way. The background appears to be well researched, and in fact the character of Nellie Coker, the author tells us, is based on the real-life Kate Mayrick, known in her time as the Queen of Soho's club scene. My only complaint really, I really enjoyed the book, but my only complaint really is that the book really winds up rather too quickly for my taste, and it leaves an ambiguous ending for what's going to be Gwendolyn's future. And then each of the other story threads are brought to a close very, very rapidly, too rapidly for my taste. I suppose it's a familiar complaint from readers, but I would have really liked the book to have gone on a bit longer and to have explored the characters' subsequent histories more fully. Nevertheless, I rated this pretty highly. I liked it a lot. I like all her books, but yeah, this was a good one, I thought.
All right. Seems like an author to watch.
Oh, yeah.
And we may well be watching a little bit closer a bit later on.
And we'll tell you about that, yeah.
Yep. So my next one is something that I've sort of discussed previously on this podcast. The book is In the Woods from 2007 by Tana French. Now, when I was discussing my favourite film and television in an episode earlier this year, I talked about a TV series called Dublin Murders. And that TV series is based on the first two books in the Dublin Murders series of novels by this particular author. Pity they didn't just concentrate on the first book, because there certainly is enough material here to be going on with. And I thought, you know, it's an excellent piece of writing. It won the Barry and Anthony Awards for Best First Novel in 2008, and has kicked off quite a popular series of novels in the Dublin Murders. Anyway, I'll give you a bit of a rundown of the plot so that we can discuss it a bit more. So, a young woman is found murdered in some woods on the outskirts of Dublin. And this is the same set of woods that 20 years before there was a mystery 20 years before about the disappearance of three young local children in that particular woods. Only one of whom ever came back. The other two were never found. This young woman has been found on what appears to be a sacramental stone altar that has been there for many hundreds, if not thousands, of years. It's been found by a bunch of archaeologists who are doing a whole lot of work in this particular woods because parts of it are going to get knocked down for a highway bypass or a new freeway. And so they're basically rapidly doing all the work they can to get all the archaeological evidence they can. And so the whole area has been particularly closed off to the general public. But this young girl is found dead on this stone artifact. Now, the interesting thing about this particular mystery is that the young boy that went missing, who was once referred to as Adam Ryan, has now changed his name to Rob Ryan. His family, once he came back, and he couldn't remember anything that had happened to him the whole of the period of the time when he was missing. They've taken the boy off to England and raised him over there. He's now come back to Dublin and joined the police force. And it so happens that he has this murder investigation land on his desk. And so he and his detective partner, Cassie, begin to investigate the death of this young woman. Now, Cassie is an interesting character in that she and Rob have a very close non-sexual relationship, but are just very, very close friends and colleagues. But she also knows everything about Rob, once Adam, and knows that he really shouldn't be working on this, and keeps on telling him that he basically shouldn't be working on this, but he's desperate to try and work out what happened, if for nothing else other than to see whether it had anything to do with his own disappearance all those years ago and the disappearance of his close friends. Now, this is a detailed and long police procedural. But that isn't to say that it's not without interest. There's a lot of things that go on here that it's very well written and very well handled. Tana French is meticulous in laying out every aspect of the investigation. And she also spends a lot of time exploring the nature of memory and trauma associated with Rob's disappearance previously, and how that might be impacting on his current work. Is he suffering from PTSD? Is what he experienced back then impacting his work now? He seems to be handling it quite well, but as it goes further and further along, you notice that the stresses and strains really start getting to him, and he starts making some fairly major mistakes, and which will have an impact on the investigation. This really is an excellent piece of work by French, especially for a debut novel. It's meticulously potted with a fine attention to detail. It is sure to be one of the best crime novels I read this year. As I said, I think the Dublin Murders television program should have had more faith in the original material, because there's a lot of very interesting stuff here they didn't actually go into. But I can heartily recommend this book. I think that it shows a lot of... It just gives you the feeling that you're in the hands of the sure touch of an author who knows what she's doing, yeah. Who knows where she's going and what she wants to get out of this, and it gradually works its way up. You can see it coming. You don't know necessarily who the culprit is, but almost that doesn't matter. It's a matter of how Rob Ryan handles his ongoing trauma and his association with his past and his present. And really quite an excellent piece of work. I gave this 4.4 out of 5.
I'm a big, big fan of Tana French's work. Unfortunately, she hasn't written anything in the last couple of years. But anyway, but that whole series of Dublin Murder Squad books are terrific. The first one here is excellent. And what I like is, there are two things I like about it in particular. The interesting relationship between Rob and Cassie, which goes through stages, but is extremely close. But as you say, non-sexual, really. That was really interesting, just how that relationship develops. And I also like the confidence she has of actually not giving you all the answers at the end. Mm. The book winds up without all the answers being given, which takes a bit of confidence, I think.
It does, actually. It sort of shows you that, you know, real life doesn't tie everything up.
Yeah.
You get most of it tied up, but some things remain mysteries, so we won't tell you what they are.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Yeah. I found that all right. I wasn't distressed by that at all.
Yeah.
In the hands of a lesser writer, you would have thought, no, she squibbed this. She just basically didn't know and then just left it.
No.
No, I think she's done a very, very good job here.
Yeah. Wonderful job. The interesting thing about the series of books, if I can just have a little riff, is that each of the books in the series of the Dublin Murder Squad books has a different point of view character.
Mm.
But the point of view character is one of the other members of the squad that you've already come across. Okay. So the point of view character in the second book is Cassie. Mm. And there's the next book, I think it might be the third book, it's one of the inspectors that they've been knocking up against and having some friction with. You know, and then the fourth book is yet another character in the squad who you've seen earlier on in the earlier books, but now she's the point of view character. You know, so that's cleverly done.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good stuff. Yeah. As I say, her last book was called The Searcher, which came out 3 years ago, I think now, or maybe even four. It's a while since she's published anything, so I hope she's still publishing. She's an actor. She started off as an actor.
Okay.
Maybe she's gone back to acting. I don't know. All right. Well, I'll go on to my last book, which again is one. We'll talk about this at the end. Is how you define what is considered to be a crime novel. So this is Bodies of Light by Jennifer Down, and it was the winner of last year's Miles Franklin Award, which is, of course, Australia's premier literary award. And right from the start, I will say that I think it was a very deserving winner. But interestingly, however, it was also nominated for last year's Davitt Award, which is given by Sisters in Crime Australia to honour the best crime novel by an Australian woman writer. And I find that a bit surprising. I found it surprising before I read the book, and I find even after reading the book, I'm still a bit puzzled by it. It's certainly true that crimes are committed in the novel, mostly with the main character as the victim of the crimes. and that the main character is accused of a terrible crime. But it's hard to see it, in my view, as a crime novel. Nevertheless, I'll continue. Enough blather, I'll go on to what the book's about. So I'm going to be giving away spoilers, and I don't think I can avoid that, so be warned. So a very, very quick plot summary. Bodies of Light is the life story of an Australian woman born in the early 1970s in Melbourne, all written from her first-person point of view. Superbly written. The narrator's story strongly engages our sympathy as we follow her through the traumas of her life. But she's definitely a survivor. She's determined to overcome the, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as Hamlet has it. So the novel itself opens with a woman called Holly, who lives in a small community in Billington, Ohio, in the United States. And she's just received a message from someone on Facebook. The man who sent it is a stranger to her. She doesn't recognize the name. He says that he's looking for someone called Maggie Sullivan and that he lived with her for a couple of years when they were both kids. He's seen a photo online somewhere in which Holly appears, and he's been struck by how similar she looks to Maggie, who went missing in 1998. So he writes to her and asks if she's a relation. Now, Holly reacts to this message with considerable panic. So we know immediately that Holly actually is Maggie Sullivan and that she desperately doesn't want to be found. The question of why and what brought her to this point is answered by the rest of the book. So we get a series of flashbacks of Maggie's life, which, as I've already indicated, hasn't at all been an easy one. Her parents are drug addicts and her mother has died from an overdose when the child is very young. A few years later, her father is imprisoned and she ends up in institutional care and lives in a series of share houses and foster homes, that sort of place. While she's there, she's sexually abused and raped at the age of 11. As she moves into her teens, she starts to experiment with drugs despite knowing the effect that they had on her parents. Eventually, though, she finds a safe foster parent who encourages her to study and to try for university, at which she succeeds with great difficulty, but drops out fairly soon after that. But the key turning point to her life, which is the big spoiler here, so be aware, the key turning point of her life is that after she's married, she has a series of babies, all of whom die in infancy or early childhood, presumably from sudden infant death syndrome. It's really hard to read this section of the book as we follow how Maggie deals with these increasingly shattering tragedies for her and for her husband, who's driven to despair. But after the final death, she's interviewed by the police and eventually charged with infanticide, purely on the basis that once is a tragedy, twice is coincidence, three times is a crime. Now, this section of the book seems to me to relate to several similar real-life cases, such as those of Kathleen Folbig in Australia and Sally Clark in England, both which cases women were imprisoned for infanticide on fairly thin evidence, really. And so here, I suppose, is the major crime component of the novel, though we ourselves have no doubt that Maggie's innocent of this crime. And looking back at her life history, however, she knows it'll count against her. You know, broken family, raised in institutional care, drug taking, you know, it's all going to look very bad if she goes to court. So, and she thinks she's very likely to be convicted. So she's charged and released on bail. But while she's on bail, she finds a way to escape. As I say, she's a survivor. The author really engages us with Maggie's story, and it's both a fascinating character study and an indictment of institutional responses to children who are in bad circumstances, sometimes taking them into much worse circumstances which will affect the rest of their lives. I was really impressed by this, and I think it's a very worthy winner of the Miles Franklin Award. But is it a crime novel? I don't know. It's not how I think of it anyway. But there's no doubt that Jennifer Downe is an Australian writer to watch, and I'll certainly be keeping an eye open for anything else that she writes. I think this is her second book. Yeah, so very, very good. Top, you know, 5 stars, basically.
Doesn't sound like a crime novel to me.
Yeah, I agree. It fits into the category.
Well, it does, I suppose.
For the podcast, so,
it's hard to, you know, well, if people are going to nominate it for a crime writing award, you sort of have to think that there's enough people out there who think it is a crime novel.
Yeah.
So is it that idea, you know, like when people try to define science fiction and they say, science fiction is what I point at when I say that's science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, sort of self-explanatory and sort of around and around in circles, but maybe that's what it is. If you consider that it's a crime novel, well, then it is a crime novel. Yeah.
Is it about the focus of the book? I'm thinking both, obviously, of Shrines of Gaiety and Bodies of Light. Is it the focus? Is the focus of the book a crime and the solution to that crime? That definitely makes a crime novel. But yes. If it's not, maybe we can call these two books crime-adjacent novels. Something like
that. Yeah, well, it sounds like that is probably more likely. Mm. The book that I discussed a while back, last episode, Rizzio, is told story of a murder that occurs in front of Mary Queen of Scots, written by a crime novelist as a depiction of real events. Is that a crime novel? Well, a crime has been committed. You know who the person is that did it, but so there's no real actual mystery in that instance. So I don't know.
Yeah,
crime adjacent.
Yeah, the other book that would fall into that category is The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is definitely about a crime and a murder, but it's not. So the focus isn't on the solution to that crime.
That's right. Yeah, and I think maybe that's it. Maybe crime novels that you and I would look at and say, right, this is absolutely definitely a crime novel, is something that's happened, which there is a mystery, whatever that may be, missing person, missing objects, death, whatever, and that somebody attempts to find out what happened, to find a solution. Maybe that's it. That's good enough as far as I'm concerned. But we are trying to read widely, and if some of crimes can actually impact all of us without it being a private investigation or a police procedural that goes on around it, David. So
yeah.
Anyway,
all right.
Whatever you think. Obviously enough people thought it was a crime novel or had enough crimes in it to be considered as such, and therefore they nominated it.
Yeah. All right.
Well, the book that I'm going to be talking about, Exiles by Jane Harper from 2022, is very definitely a crime novel. And this is the third in Jane Harper's series featuring Australian Federal Police Officer Aaron Falk, following The Dry in 2016 and Force of Nature in 2017. She's also written two other standalone novels, in The Lost Man 2018 and The Survivors in 2020. All of these books are of interest, and I would recommend that people read all of them. my preference was for The Dry and The Lost Man. And I think this one's sort of up there. I think it's certainly better than Force of Nature, and probably better than The Survivors as well. So I think this one's worth reading. Anyway, so to start off with, a year before the main timeline of this novel, Aaron Falk had been in a small Australian winemaking town of Marilee, visiting the annual Marilee Valley Food and Wine Festival at the invitation of some friends who live in the town. My wife and I were discussing this just recently, and she said, do you think it's based on McLaren Vale or the Barossa Valley? I think it's the Barossa, but doesn't really matter. It's not. It's a fictional wine-growing area somewhere in South Australia. Your choice. You can light it up to be whatever you feel like. But I think it's probably the Barossa. Anyway, now during that festival, this is a year before the main timeline of the novel, during that festival, 39-year-old Kim Gillespie went missing, leaving her 6-year-old daughter alone in a stroller. A frantic search for the woman found nothing at all, a year later, the mystery remains unsolved. So we're now back to the main timeline, a year after this, and Falk is back in town for the festival, again staying with his friend, Greg Rako, who's a police officer, who was uncle to Gillespie's teenage daughter. So this is Kim Gillespie had a teenage daughter as well as a new relationship and a 6-year-old daughter. And Greg Rako persuades Falk to have a look over the material he's gathered on the disappearance, but nothing initially seems to stand out. We learn that Gillespie's husband had a very firm alibi for the night, and that Gillespie had been suffering from depression One of her shoes has been found in a nearby reservoir, and it's generally considered that she committed suicide, but nobody can fathom why. Now, in the background to all of this, there's a six-year-old fatal hit-and-run case of a man called Dean Tozer, the late husband of a woman that Falk is interested in, who lives in the town. And the two cases, both being unresolved, could be connected, though no one can really find out whether there's a link between the two or not. Now, the novel explores both of these mysteries against the backdrop of the festival and the christening of Greg's young child, in which Falk's nominated as the godfather. And what we have here is a slowly evolving mystery with subtle turns, as every minute of the night that Gillespie went missing is dissected and analysed and looked over and tracked down, and they try to talk to everybody that was there and around the place and to try to work out what happened to this poor woman. Now, the reveal, when it comes, certainly one that fooled me and absolutely threw me completely. I was quite taken aback by how well the author had hidden every single thing that you needed to do to keep this revelation as sort of a mystery. And when you go back and have a think about what's there, you go, oh, that was so, well, yeah, okay. You know, you sort of look at it everywhere down the line, you go, missed that. That was very subtle. That was all the way right through. She sort of told you but didn't tell you, and she did some really, really, she does some really, really good work in this particular book. All the clues are there for you. You just have to interpret them in exactly the right way, and all of the details woven into the whole story. I found it a bit slow to start off with, to get going, but I also found it a compelling read. There was just something that sort of drags you on. There are times when you can read a book and you just feel like it's just, like I said with the Vargas novel, it just seems to go round and round and round in circles and not get anywhere. And then when it does keep going, it goes. This one just kept on moving forward all the time. There was always something that sort of dragged you along and pulled you forward all the time. And I found this, you know, pretty much this is a compelling read, and it's up there with the first of the books in this particular series, The Dry. I gave this one 4.4 out of 5. I don't think it'll be giving much away, because I think basically the author stated this. I don't think she'll be writing any more books about Aaron Falk. She might some stage down the track, so that tells you that he doesn't cark it by the end of it. I'll give that much away. He does actually make it to the end of this particular book. And does a good job in what he sets out to do. An interesting novel, and certainly worth your time, David. Worthwhile having a bit of a look at.
Yeah, certainly,
she's one of those people that Australian authors that, you know, if you want to know what's going on in Australian crime fiction, you really should be reading what she's writing. That's basically it.
Yep, indeed. All right, good.
Okay, well, I think we're done.
I think so.
For that. I think we've been rattling on quite long enough for stuff about crime novels, and people can tell we're quite interested in crime fiction. Are we interested in it as much as science fiction? I think you are, David. From what I've gathered, I think you you would tend to read more crime fiction than science fiction these days.
These days, yeah, I probably do. Yeah, but yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's all right.
We try to read
across both genres, and there's a fair bit to get through. There's a lot of material always coming out.
Sure.
So I think we're done
for
this particular week, David. And so what are we up to next time?
Well, you have a cunning plan, I believe.
So
we can tell them about the cunning plan, if you like.
The cunning plan was that I discovered that... Well, we were talking about Kate Atkinson early on in this particular episode with the novel that David reviewed. I hadn't realised that David was actually going to review a novel by Kate Atkinson this time around.
Yeah,
but I had spoken to him some time back because I had discovered that a TV adaptation had been made of a novel of Kate Atkinson's by the title of Life After Life. And I thought that it might be an interesting exercise for us to watch that TV adaptation and to also consider the novel on which it was based. Now, this is, I'll only say that this is an interesting novel which fits into what might be referred to as the sub-genre of science fiction known as the time loop.
Yes,
sort of fits into that, which we shall discuss at greater length next episode, but I won't say anything further. The TV adaptation was from 2022, made by the BBC.
Yeah, it was excellent. Yes, excellent.
Yes, and so we've both watched it, and we have to finish off the novel before next episode.
Well, I've read it before, but I will read it again before the next episode.
So that's what we'll be talking about then.
Indeed.
All right, David, that's
see
it.
You then. Okay.
Well, see you in a few weeks.
Catch you next time. Okay, bye.